And right now it is time for the following.
If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake, baked a cake, baked a cake. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. How'd you do? How'd you do? How'd you do?
Let's see if you baked a cake this weekend.
No cake here.
Good morning, Arthur.
You know, I it's interesting because I'm diabetic, and I could eat a piece of cake, you know, or a small piece of cake anyway. But I don't bake anymore. And the other day I'm thinking, you know, if I have to treat myself, it should be my own food. So I think I might bake a cake. Anyway, that was totally off the subject that I wanted to talk about, which is...
Wait.
Wait for what?
Is there a cake recipe in there?
Oh. Well, let's tell them what the there is.
Okay.
I've been wondering lately, whatever happened to the project taken on by Macmillan Publishing of doing a series of what they're calling classic cookbooks, among which is Cooking in a Small Kitchen, my first cookbook, which was published in 1979, and is dedicated, by the way, to my nephew, who was due the same time as my book. So my sister and I thought, well, that was cute. In any case, Brian is now 40. I got to ask him if he has a copy of this. I did find an extra. In any case, I haven't heard. Macmillan paid me half of my advance for this new book they're going to do, Cooking in a Small Kitchen, as part of a classic cookbook series. And I haven't heard from them. And I don't know, maybe it's a year and a half, 2 years. I know I claimed this half of an advance in 2016 on my taxes. So, because it wasn't very much, by the way. It's a pitiful amount of money. So I guess I'm due the second half, because this morning I wake up to an email from Macmillan saying, oh, here's the cover of your new book. Don't you love it? We love it. And I don't love it. But then again, I hated the original cover of the book. So,
except for the picture on the back.
Except for the picture on the back. The front cover has, I don't know whose kitchen it is. It looks to me like a pretty big kitchen that they jammed everything in the corner. And on the back, I don't think the new edition has me at age 30 on the back. Is it 30? Was I 30? Yeah, it's 30. So maybe 31. And I've got to say, I was slim then, and my beard was fuller and darker, and I had a Jufro. You know, I had a lot of curly hair in a rounded, do, which we then used to call a Jufro, because it wasn't an Afro, it was on a Jewish guy. So it was very stylish, by the way. Even waspy guys with blonde hair had their hair permed into this look. What's interesting to me about the picture, though, is not me, but some of the stuff that's in the background here that was later stolen by my landlady. I'm not joking. She broke in. She was harassing me out of the building. Her mother was my landlady. Her mother died, and she wanted to take over the whole thing. And I had a lease, and she used to break into my apartment and steal stuff, which she then sold in her supposed like antique store in Nyack, New York. I once went up there to see if she still had any of my stuff, but it was too late. The only thing in this picture that I really miss is a Renault wine poster. Renault was a New Jersey winery from pre-Prohibition. And so this has got, you know, it's from the turn of the century. And I had a little original poster. I think, if I can read it correctly, it says 15 cents a bottle. So anyway, but the book itself, I decided not to be embarrassed by it. Everybody's cooking changes over 40 years. And there are some recipes in here I wouldn't do the way they're done anymore. Not to say I wouldn't like to do some kind of recipe like that. And a lot of the stuff is I would cook now. And in fact, it's inspired me to make a few things now that I haven't made in a very long time. I actually only got through the soup chapter, And now I'm looking at the black bean soup, and you know what? This is practically the same as I do now. I've been making black bean soup a lot.
Well, I just want to interject because one of the things that I was noticing in a fit of just sort of culinary boredom mm-hmm. is that I make the same things a lot because in the end, that's what and I make them the same, similar way to the way that I made them initially because that's in the end what I like.
Yeah, but let me say, the ingredients have changed
sure.
a lot.
Certainly.
For instance, I'm noticing, and I haven't read all through the whole book yet. I mean, remember, I wrote this 40 years ago, and I look at the recipes from time to time, but I didn't like go page by page reading. But what's clear is that you could not get great olive oil then. I even say, oh, you're probably never going to find Tuscan olive oil except that stuff from Lucca. Which is, I think, Bertoli or Berio. One of those is made in Lucca. And, you know, they have a blending plant in Lucca where they churn out this stuff. But it's not actually, part of it may be Italian oil, but usually it's other oil mixed in, at least. And not to say it's bad oil, but it's not my oil of choice by a long shot. That's, you know, it's processed. It's not even the extra virgin olive oil of those companies. But in any case, they have them now. They didn't exist, extra virgin olive oil. I remember back in the 70s when I was doing this cooking that became Cooking in a Small Kitchen. By the way, the book's not out yet. I'll tell you when the book is out. I will also get another check when the book is out. It'll be just enough to take us out for a good steak dinner, something I don't cook at home very much, and with Gary Rogers, who did the illustrations. Gary was a young whippersnapper. Let's see, if this was 40 years ago, Gary was probably in his 20s, because Gary retired last year as a design director at Newsday. He stayed at, we met each other at Newsday. I wrote this while I was still at Newsday in the 70s. So, we'll all go out to dinner with his other half, whose name is Miriam Smith. I don't know if they ever married, but they're certainly together for 40 years. That counts a lot.
Do you remember what common law used to be?
I do remember. I think it may still exist in some states.
Yeah.
Common law just came up with me about owning a copyright. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. Let's do cooking instead. So I'm sort of proud of the book. The writing isn't bad. From time to time I wince. But, you know, it was 40 years ago.
You evolved.
I have evolved, yes, and so has my. And interestingly, my cooking has not evolved as much as I really thought. I use a lot less sugar these days. I wince when I see recipe. For instance, this morning, I don't know where I was. It wasn't on the New York Times cooking site. I'll get to that in a minute. But I was somewhere, and they were promoting, I don't know what else to call it, I think because it came with a commercial attachment, now classic recipe called Chicken Marbella. Do you remember Chicken Marbella? It was in what's the name? Oh, come on, Arthur. Senior moment here. It'll come to me. Anyway, I'm going to look on my bookshelf here. It's in this famous book, which even on its 25th anniversary, got a big splash. I mean, this is terrible that I can't remember this. But in any case, it calls for like a cup of brown sugar. I would never make a savory dish anymore. By the way, I'm sure there are people listening to us yelling at me about what the name of the book is. And it was a store on, here we go.
What, Silver Palette?
Thank you.
Oh, that was easy.
Yeah, that was easy for you, difficult for me.
No, but yeah, the reason it's easy is because don't forget the Barefoot Contessa and the Silver Palette. Like, didn't they pretty much open around the same time? Wasn't that the
beginning? I don't know. But Contessa was out there. Ina Garten was out there in the Hamptons.
Right, but she had this little teeny store in the city, I believe, also.
Well, Julie Rosso and Sheila Lukens, who were the founders of the Silver Palette. By the way, the Silver Palette name still exists on a line of salad dressings, and I think they used to call them splashes.
Well, right.
I think they made the product, they still say splash. I don't know. But I from time to time, I see Silver Palette products around. Sheila and Julie just opened this little store on the Upper West Side where they, you know, where a lot of celebrities and powerful people lived even back then in the 70s. And, you know, it was sort of the lefty, it was the left side of Manhattan and a lefty neighborhood with people who disdained cooking, I have to say. This is a big issue with me these days. And a lot of people disdain cooking these days, even though they love to eat. They have to know that somebody prepares the food, right?
Wait. What do you mean? What, just
I'm getting off subject here, opened up a takeout store in the early days of takeout.
Yeah.
And it was good food. For those days, it was adventurous food. And, you know, lots of salad. Anyway, so that became a cookbook and then a real brand. And but as a friend of mine... Suzanne Hamlin, and then a reporter for the Daily News. I was her editor at the Daily News. She said about, I guess it was the first cookbook. So the first cookbook must have come out in 1980, 81, because
there were two.
When I got my job at the Daily News. And Suzanne said, it's a great cookbook if you leave off the last seven ingredients.
And that's what's really, that talk about evolving. There was, first it was Silver Palette, the Silver Palette cookbook, which was, but there were a couple things. And then there was the Silver Palette Good Times, which was like the fancy, like this is what you make.
Oh, yeah. So, that, well, then there was also.
And then there was the big
the new
one.
Basics
new
was
Basics.
Another one. The New Basics. And then Julie and Gossip. Then Julie, who I'm not friends with, and Sheila, who I was friends with. Had some huge
falling out,
and Sheila went on her own without Julie, because Sheila was the cook.
Right.
Julie was the businesswoman and promoter and the marketing person. Sheila did very good marketing of herself, but more or less. At one point, her husband left. It's a big... long story. I don't need to tell Sheila's history here. But she went on to write other cookbooks on her own and also to become the food editor of Parade magazine, which probably still is the most syndicated food pages in America. Parade is a Sunday insert that goes into papers all over the country. So...
yeah, and people should never. It's funny. There are things that you know. Speaking of disdaining cooking and being all prep and no, you know, all takeout. No, there are things such as Parade that people should widen their knowledge base if they don't know about that.
Okay.
Okay.
So moving back to cooking, which is what we're here about, I think.
Yeah.
I'm amazed at 1979. Actually, 1978. If you think about it, because the book, as you can see, with just bringing out a book that already exists with illustrations and blah, 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 it's taken them at least a year and a half. Maybe it's already 2 years. It's close to 2 years in publishing. So this book was published in 1979. I was cooking this food and I actually wrote the book at least a year before that.
Yeah, it had to be about 77.
Yeah, so I'm saying I was pretty sophisticated when I was 30 years old. I was making carpaccio. Nobody knew about carpaccio back then.
Could I just say that sort of makes sense, given...
Now it's a cliche, but, you know, right, then it was new.
But given your background, Because when you look at the big circles, okay, and how people are getting back to the way that their grandparents cooked, what you did distilled what you learned from those basics. So,
well, it's funny you say that, because somebody recently asked me, who did you learn how to cook from, your grandma? And I thought about very quickly, I don't know how I came up with this, I said, you know, I learned from hundreds of grandmas, because that was my thing. When I was young, and at Newsday, which allowed me to do this, my thing was to go cook with grandmas and learn about the food of these different communities. And there still were grandmas from the old country back in the 1970s. They weren't grandmas who grew up in Riverdale. So, I don't know why I said Riverdale. People who grow up in Sharon.
Right.
But
they also knew how those things tasted and could recreate those tastes.
Well, they sort of did.
Sort of, right.
Yeah, now I know better. Now I know if you really want to know. Well, I was going to say you have to go back to the country from whence it came, but that's not true so much. Because those countries have changed.
But I will say
Listen, food changes all the time, every day. So it's one of the challenges of owning a restaurant where people expect consistency is that the food itself is not consistent. You start with raw ingredients, and it's sometimes hard to make them do what you want them to do. And they do what they want to do.
Something interesting, though, at least to me, a friend recently brought to me from what is known as the best cheese shop in the world, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, which is in France, and it's called, I think, Les Alpages, this Gruyere cheese. And he brought it, and I ate it, and I have to tell you, it is incredible. But the thing that is most incredible about it is it doesn't taste. You can go to a good cheesemonger and get Gruyere, and it does not taste the same as this Gruyere did. And I thought that was most, I don't know, I just thought that was interesting on a certain level, because it came from those
ingredients.
That, exactly.
It was, first of all, Gruyere is an aged cheese. So chances are, I'm thinking, that this was a raw milk cheese, which must be aged to be imported into the U.S. Oh, but this is a friend who carried it.
Yeah, he bought it.
By the way, you can carry, but for everybody who travels, you are allowed to carry home raw milk cheeses for your own consumption. It's only the importation commercially that's not allowed, unless the cheese is aged at least 60 days. And, of course, Gruyere is aged for years. So, but it probably was a raw milk Gruyere. I mean, I've tasted raw milk versions of things next to pasteurized milk versions, and there's definitely a difference. But back to cooking in a small kitchen, I still cook a lot like, if not these very recipes, although I'm going to re-cook some. I did when they told me that it was going to be reissued in this Macmillan series. I did cook a few things, and I was happy with them, so it was a sort of random pick a page and make something. But I made something over the weekend that would fit perfectly in this book, because it's cooked in one pot. It's extremely simple and healthy. And in fact, the reason I made it is because I am diabetic, to close the show, my segment here, with what I started with. I'm diabetic, and lentils are a great food. It's certainly a great carbohydrate for people who have diabetes. It is the highest protein legume, and they're already all high in protein. A significant amount of their carbohydrate content is what we call fiber. So it's not actually, it's not on what high on the glycemic scale. It takes a long time to digest. And there's so many things you can do with lentils. So I don't know where this came from. I do know. Now I remember where it came from. I always keep a jar of red lentils, which are actually shelled lentils, on my actually spice rack. It's not a big jar, because I use them to thicken, like beef stew or gravies, instead of using flour. because they dissolve. The red lentils will dissolve with relatively short cooking. So, and they do a great thickening job. And yes, they have a particular flavor, but if you're making a dark gravy or even a soup that you want thickened a little bit, but you don't want to add potato or starch, like flour or cornstarch, which I don't really like in soup, then lentils do the job. But anyway, I used up all my lentils, and you know what? I'm so used to looking at this beautiful jar of lentils that I said, oh, you know, next time I go to the market, I've got to buy a bag of lentils. And then, of course, now that I have them in the house, I had to make this lentil soup recipe I found. It's Melissa Clark at the New York Times. I think it's on the cooking. I don't think I found it by searching the cooking website. But in any case, it was in Sam Sifton's newsletter this morning, a link to this recipe. And it's a super easy recipe. You saute, I think Melissa calls for 3 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 1 large onion. This can be any kind of onion you want. I didn't have a large onion. I used 2 smaller onions. I would say it amounted to about 8 ounces of onion, a half a pound of onion. Chopped, doesn't have to be all that fine, but I like to mince fine. And 2 cloves of garlic, also chopped fine. And you saute that in 3 tablespoons of olive oil over pretty high heat, she said. And I was doubting, you know, do I want a high heat here? But in fact, I was making this in my, I must say, cooking in a small kitchen. I'm still using the same pot that I was cooking in 40 years ago. It is a 2.5 or 2¾ cup, quart, Le Creuset, in flame red, the old-fashioned flame red. And I've cleaned this a few times, by the way, with Easy Off. I find that actually I can make it look semi-new. In any case, you saute your onion in 3 tablespoons of olive oil with the 2 cloves of garlic. Only needs 5 or 6 minutes until they become not tender, but, you know, translucent anyway. And then you add, for seasoning, a tablespoon of tomato paste and a teaspoon of cumin. And I didn't use any salt because I was making this with very good broth that I had. I made homemade broth. And Melissa tells you to add 1 quart of broth and 2 cups. I mean, I'm sorry, 1 quart of broth and 2 cups of water. I used 6 cups of my good broth. And that's pretty much it. And a cup of lentils, of red lentils. And you boil this 20 minutes, a half an hour, until the lentils have totally disintegrated. I left out an ingredient. 1 large carrot. You add that with the lentils. You don't have to saute anything. You just add it with boiling lentils. 1 large carrot diced. I made nice, neat dices because in the end, after it cooks for half an hour, you puree half of it, and the other half you leave sort of lumpy, and it's a delicious coarse puree, and then you get those nice cubes of red carrot. It's very attractive. Melissa tells you to drizzle it with a little olive oil. You could do that, and also if you want a little hot pepper on top. I put a little hot pepper in mine, too. Cumin, and maybe an eighth of a teaspoon of cayenne pepper. It's 8 o'clock, folks.
Sounds good.
It was delicious.
It was
a large amount of soup for 3 people.
And
you could have had for 4 people.
Okay.
Yeah. And it not even fattening.
And it isn't even soup suppers.
No, it's Melissa Clark's recipe. You can look up the exact recipe at the New York Times cooking site.
All right.
And just, I think it's, oh, a squeeze of lemon at the end.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. I forgot that. I'm not reading it. I'm just, you know, I know now I know it on the top of my head because I'm going to make it again.
Okay.
Right. And again.
And again.
Perhaps.
All right. Happy New
Talk
Year.
Talk to you next week, kids. Happy New Year, everyone.
Thanks. All right, Arthur. Take care. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven here on Robinhood Radio. You can also find him on demand, robinhoodradio.com on the web.
Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven from Hathaway Young, located on South Center Street in Millerton. Flawless catering and event planning, HathawayYoung.com. John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, JARestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Groceries on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, Rubiner's.com. In Hillsdale, New York, Hillsdale Home Chef with two beautiful teaching classes, and they've got classes to go in those cooking rooms. More information, 518-325-7000, hghomechef.com. And Haven Cafe in Lenox, Massachusetts, offering quality food and excellent service. From a fresh cup of great coffee to healthy, delicious breakfast, or sit down with a dinner with a tasty, life-enhancing meal that you can take home. Also, they feature catering. Supporting local organic farmers, environmentally conscious, and epicurious distributors, HavenCafeBakery.com.